Hello, everyone, and welcome to On Science, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk at NPR. I'm Adam Cole, one of the interns here. This week, as Space Shuttle Discovery orbits the Earth, we've got stories about technology and the environment. Our inventions have long-term effects on our planet and help us explore beyond it. We'll hear about scientists struggling to gather useful information in the aftermath of the Gulf oil spill and a warning from the World Resources Institute. Coral reefs are in big, big trouble. A California company is leasing out solar panels. And a new study shows radio waves from cell phones are changing the metabolism of the brain. Meanwhile, researchers turn to space to listen for another kind of transmission, the high-frequency humming of stars. But first, one of NASA's three space shuttles has lifted off for the last time.
Go for main engine start. We have main engine start. 2, 1. Booster ignition and the final liftoff of Discovery. A tribute to the dedication, hard work, and pride of America's space shuttle team. The shuttle has cleared the tower.
Space Shuttle Discovery, which debuted in 1984, is now on its way to the space station for one final mission. It's an emotional time for NASA, as Discovery will be the first shuttle to be retired, marking the beginning of an end to an era. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has this look at the life of the beloved spaceship.
This is Your Life, a program for all America. And now here
okay, is I'm not famous TV host Ralph Edwards. And Discovery, you aren't even human. But nonetheless, this is Your Life. Are you surprised? Don't be. So many people are thinking of you as you get ready for your last trip. Here's one voice from your past.
Everybody calls me Hank.
That's right, your first commander, Hank Hartsfield. When he met you, you were just the third in NASA's shuttle fleet. No one knew you'd be special.
Yeah, it was a new vehicle, and it looked like the others.
3, 2, 1. We have SRB ignition, and we have liftoff. Liftoff of mission 41D, the first flight of the orbiter Discovery. And the shuttle.
Up and up you roared, soaring to the silence of space. You began to circle our planet, seeing a sunrise and a sunset every 90 minutes. You took a call from President Ronald Reagan.
Our thoughts and our prayers are with you, believe me. And I say that for myself and Nancy, and I know for all America.
So what if he was really talking to your crew? More than 26 years later, the man who commanded that crew, Hank Hartsfield, remembers you fondly. And he has this message just for you.
I would say keep up your wonderful record for at least one more flight.
Good morning, outer space, from all the human race, it's time to stow your sleeping gear.
Remember that musical wake-up call?
Good morning, Discovery.
It's just one of so many songs you heard beamed up from Houston at the start of each day. Your days in space add up to almost a whole year. You're about to make your 39th mission, more flights than any other shuttle.
Discovery is the champion of the shuttle fleet.
That's Valerie Neal of the National Air and Space Museum. She's got her eye on you, Discovery. She wants to put you in her museum.
Everything that the space shuttle was intended to do, Discovery and only Discovery has done.
You've deployed satellites, including the Hubble Space Telescope. You've done science missions. You hauled up big chunks of the International Space Station. And both times NASA had its heart broken by a disaster, Challenger and Columbia, you were the first shuttle to return to flight. Your crews have included a bunch of famous firsts. The first Russian cosmonaut to ride on a shuttle, the first female pilot, the first African-American commander. And then there was John Glenn, the first American to orbit the Earth, who returned to orbit with you in 1998. 194 different astronauts have traveled with you. One is Nicole Stott. She'll join you again for your final mission.
It is a historic thing, I think, that we have such a special vehicle to fly. And the hope, in addition to having a successful mission, is that in conclusion we'll be celebrating just the real significance of the vehicle itself.
Now, let's face it, Discovery. You did spend most of your life on the ground. Often, like now, you've waited at your launch pad. It has a nice view of the ocean, but you're a little vulnerable out there. Once you got badly pummeled by hail. And remember the time woodpeckers drilled holes all over your fuel tank?
Whenever something happens that causes any type of damage or concern with the vehicle, we take that very personally.
That's Stephanie Stilson at Kennedy Space Center in Florida. You must recognize her voice. For over a decade, she's led the folks on the ground who tend to your every need. Over and over, these workers nurture you, protect you, and then, amazed, watch you leave the nest.
We really become attached to that orbiter and really consider it almost like a baby.
She says your final mission makes her sad.
I would love to see Discovery continue to fly, as would everybody else that I work with as well. We all would love to see the shuttle program continue for years and years.
But the shuttle era is ending. So it's time for you to once again go first and become the first shuttle to be retired. This has been your life. It's one you've shared with lots of people. Many of them will be saying, "Godspeed, Discovery," as you blast off towards the stars for the very last time. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
The BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico was, in effect, a huge experiment. Scientists want to know what that oil may do to the plants and animals that live in the Gulf, from seagrasses to turtles to giant bluefin tuna. But many of those scientists say their work is being held up. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, science delayed may be science denied.
After the spill, scientists swarmed over the Gulf like mosquitoes at a summer garden party. Mostly, they looked for bodies, birds, fish, turtles. Universities footed the bill, and the National Science Foundation provided about $20 million for research. The Interior Department and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration sent experts, too. But the real gumshoe work is just beginning. Will wetlands recover? Were tiny fish eggs and larvae wiped out? Will surviving animals reproduce?
It's a huge challenge.
Christopher Dahlia runs the School of the Coast and Environment at Louisiana State University.
You know, in the military talks about the fog of war. In this particular case, we're dealing with sort of a fog of research.
In the military, there are generals, but not in ecological research. Stan Senner is with the environmental group, the Ocean Conservancy.
There really isn't anyone in charge.
True, the federal government's scientists are doing some research now, but most of that lies beneath a veil laid down by the Oil Pollution Act. The act calls for research in order to assess damages against those responsible for oil spills. Because that may involve litigation, that research is largely secret.
Dozens and dozens of studies are in the field. Thousands and thousands of samples have been gathered. But that work is largely being held confidential.
Eventually, that scientific data should become public. But Senner and other scientists worry that in the meantime, gaps in the research may go unnoticed without peer review from the larger scientific community. Senner, who worked on the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska, says secrecy sows doubt among the public.
We saw repeatedly in the case of the Exxon Valdez that the people who are most affected by the spill, if they didn't have information, it tended to feed their worst fears.
There is some money for independent open research, the $20 million from the National Science Foundation, for example, but that money runs out soon. And Christopher Dahlia points out that now is a bad time for research money to dry up.
We're going to have an interesting time in the springtime because we're about to come into the season when life starts teeming in the coastal waters. So one of the big issues that I'm concerned about is what's going to happen to the food chains, the food webs, off the coast of Louisiana in particular, where the oiling was the heaviest.
Ironically, it's BP that has spent the most for independent open research. Shortly after the spill, BP gave several universities and research groups in the Gulf about $50 million, with the promise of another $450 million over 10 years. BP and the Gulf states picked a board of scientists to decide who gets the money. Rita Colwell, a life scientist at the University of Maryland, is head of the board.
We are gathering the data to be published in the open literature, and anybody can use it. Private individuals, BP, federal government, anyone.
But the other $450 million that BP promised has not materialized. Colwell says recruiting the research board and writing ethical rules for research took a long time. The board still has not published guidelines for how to apply for money, so it could be months before scientists see any of that $450 million. And that worries scientists like Don Bosch, who sits on the official oil spill commission that's investigating the event. He says the slow start has already compromised the research effort.
Because we had much more limited effort to go out and actually describe the effects of the spill and track the oil when it was actually coming out of the bottom of the Gulf.
Scientists say they need to be out in the Gulf now, and they need someone to organize all independent research going on. They cite the case of herring in Alaska's Prince William Sound. 4 years after the Exxon Valdez spill, scientists thought the population had recovered, but they failed to read all the signs. The population crashed and has never recovered. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
A major new survey of the world's coral reefs finds that they are in trouble. Big trouble. Overfishing and local pollution continue to grow as threats, and their long-term existence is in doubt because the world's oceans are gradually getting warmer and more acidic due to human activity. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Coral reefs are spectacular ecosystems, overflowing with diverse and colorful marine life. They're also the source of food and economic sustenance to 500 million people around the world. Loretta Burke from the World Resources Institute is on a scientific team that has just finished measuring their health.
Currently, we find 75% of the world's reefs are threatened by the combination of local and global threats. By 2030, the percentage will rise to 90%. By 2050, virtually all reefs will be threatened.
Many of the risks are familiar and long-standing. At a news conference today, Burke talked about overfishing, runoff of sewage, and sediments from the shore.
But perhaps the most short-sighted threat to reefs is the use of destructive fishing practices, the use of poisons to stun and capture fish, the use of explosives to kill fish.
The report also folds in global threats. Greenhouse gases pouring into the atmosphere from our tailpipes and chimneys warm the oceans, causing heat stress to corals. Lots of that carbon dioxide also dissolves in the ocean, creating carbonic acid, which can eventually corrode coral and other shell-building animals. Add it all together, and Nancy Knowlton from the Smithsonian Institution says one-third of all coral species are at risk of extinction.
This makes corals the most endangered animal on the planet, even more endangered than frogs, which have gotten a lot of press because of the diseases that have wiped out a lot of frog populations. And of course, this is just the corals. It doesn't really count all the things that depend on corals.
These are dire projections.
Again, Loretta Burke. She says it doesn't have to be this way.
These results assume no improvement in management, no reduction in local threats, and that we continue on our current trajectory of greenhouse gas emissions.
And that current emissions trajectory does give us a small grace period, says Nancy Knowlton.
The tipping point comes sometime between about 2040 and 2050, which is not that far away.
Local threats are potentially easier to deal with, and there has been some progress in that regard. For example, President George W. Bush created vast marine protected areas in the Pacific to preserve reefs in U.S. territorial waters.
We obviously need more marine protected areas, not just big ones like these, but also small ones, local ones, like where has been mentioned in the Philippines and elsewhere in the developing world, where major marine protected areas are not financially possible, but small marine protected areas can do a lot of good.
In releasing this report today, the World Resources Institute got help from one of the premier marine biologists in this country, Jane Lubchenco, who now runs the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
It will take a Herculean effort to reverse the current trajectory and leave healthy ocean ecosystems to our children and grandchildren.
Nobody sounded too optimistic about that task. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Growing concerns about climate change and dwindling oil supplies create an opportunity for alternative energy sources. A 4-year-old California company has found a way to make solar panels affordable. But as NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports, you can't get them unless your state offers incentives for clean energy.
SolarCity lets its customers lease solar panels. They don't have to shell out a lot of money up front to buy them. Customers often pay less for leases and their electric bills than they used to pay for their electric bills alone. The company is expanding into New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts. SolarCity CEO Lyndon Reeve says all these states offer rebates and tax incentives for installing solar panels.
A key thing for us when we move into a market is, can we save a business or a homeowner money? And if there's no local incentive, you can't do it.
Massachusetts offers rebates, loans, and tax breaks. It also requires utilities to produce about 1% of their electricity from solar. As a result, homeowners and companies end up getting discounts on solar panel installations. This all sweetens a 30% federal tax credit. Rick Sullivan is Massachusetts Secretary of Energy and Environmental Affairs. He says SolarCity's announcement is more proof that the incentives are paying off.
The companies are coming into Massachusetts. The existing companies are growing in Massachusetts, and they're creating jobs. They're becoming a very important part of the economy.
Solar installations in the state are up 20-fold, and prices are coming down. Sullivan says the goal is for economies of scale to kick in and make solar panels affordable without the incentives. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
A new study finds that the radio waves from a cell phone can affect the metabolism of a person's brain. But, as NPR's John Hamilton reports, researchers say there's no evidence that it's harmful.
The human brain relies on electrical signals, so it makes sense that the electromagnetic energy that a cell phone puts out might affect brain cells. Nora Volkoff is a brain researcher and director of an NIH institute. She was intrigued by this possibility, for personal as well as professional reasons.
I'm also seeing many of my relatives and friends spending hours on their cell phones, and the question in my brain is, could this have any effect?
Volkoff knew that some MRI scanners produce electrical and magnetic fields powerful enough to cause brain cells to consume more energy in the form of glucose.
Glucose metabolism goes up when you activate your brain, when you're thinking, when you're speaking. Because you need the energy source in order for cells to function.
She wanted to know whether the electromagnetic fields produced by cell phones were strong enough to affect glucose metabolism in the brain cells the same way a scanner can. So she and a team of researchers studied 47 people.
We put two cell phones, one in the left ear, one in the right ear.
And they muted the sound on both phones to make sure it wasn't the sound of someone talking that affected parts of the brain. The participants couldn't even tell whether the cell phones were on. Then the researchers activated the phone on one side and used a PET scanner to measure how much glucose was being consumed by brain cells. Volkoff says a 50-minute call boosted brain metabolism.
There was an overall increase, approximately 6 to 8%, but only on the areas of the brain that were close to the antenna.
Volkoff says that increase in brain metabolism is not terribly dramatic. Studies have shown that just opening your eyes can produce a much greater change in brain cells that process visual information.
Based on this finding, I cannot say, is this bad, that you're increasing glucose metabolism, or could it be good?
Some researchers say the study offers more questions than answers.
What about long-term use, and what about children and young persons?
Lennart Hardell, a cancer researcher in Sweden, co-wrote an editorial accompanying the study.
There are many questions which are now raised from this very, very important study.
Hardell thinks one of those questions involves cancer. He says there's no direct link between increased brain metabolism and cancer, but he says it's still possible there is an indirect one. Stephen Novella, a neurologist at Yale, thinks even an indirect link is unlikely. He says almost everything affects metabolism.
You know, if you go into a warmer room, your metabolism will increase. And in fact, you know, the authors were speculating somewhat about how much of this increase they measured could be due just to the fact that the phone is warm and it warms up the tissue.
The authors agree with Novella that there's no reason to think the changes they noticed would increase anyone's risk of cancer. And Novella says there's not much reason to worry about other health risks either. He says reassuring results from several large international studies have found that if there is any risk from cell phone radiation, it must be very small.
If you want to minimize even the small remaining risk that is still there, you could do things like, you know, use a landline when one's available rather than your cell phone, or you can, you know, use the phone on speaker so that you're holding it away from your head rather than up against your ear.
And Novella says these precautions are probably more important for children than adults. The new study appears in the Journal of the American Medical Association. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Earlier this month, NASA's Kepler mission announced that it had found 54 planets orbiting stars in so-called habitable zones in our galaxy. Then, the SETI Institute, that's the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, turned their radio telescopes toward those 54 planets, listening for signs of life. Nothing yet. But, as producer Brent Bachman reports, intelligent life isn't the only thing that makes noise in space.
This is the sound of a star. And it's true that in space no one can hear you scream, but this sound didn't travel through space as a sound. It traveled as wave energy, just like my voice is reaching your radio.
This particular one is Kepler ID 767-1081.
NASA researcher John Jenkins created this recording just like your radio might, by transforming wave energy, in this case light, into sound. As part of the Kepler mission, Jenkins was measuring the light from this star to see whether there were any planets nearby.
When I started looking at these light curves, when we plot them up on the computer screen, I thought, well, gosh, what if we played one of these through a sound card and it said, "Hello, Earthlings!" Unfortunately, we haven't heard that yet, but we have heard a lot of other very interesting things.
John Jenkins says this star and the way it pulsates represents a mystery astronomers have grappled with for more than 100 years.
They understand the basic mechanism causing the pulsations. What they don't understand is they don't understand why the intensity of the pulsations changes over time.
One possible remote explanation for this? Alien life forms trying to contact us.
It would be quite awesome to think of an advanced civilization that is so advanced that it could actually modulate the brightness variations of its star. And it's not such a crazy idea. People have actually suggested in the literature that a civilization that's sufficiently advanced could actually tickle the star. So, in fact, we have some people on our science team who are actually examining stars to see whether they find evidence of this.
So you're suggesting that mysterious pulsating star could be like an alien's version of a mirror on a desert island.
That's right. They could be sending us cosmic smoke signals across the galaxy.
Would you like to swing on a star?
How do you tickle a star?
You know, I don't actually know. I think it would be quite complicated. I'm not sure if I'd want to try that. But, you know, the star might actually like it. I don't know. Would you rather be a mule?
Very few people know more about sound in space.
Hello.
Then Don Gurnett.
Yes, hi, Brent.
He's a physics professor at the University of Iowa, and he's been studying and collecting space sounds for more than 40 years.
I can remember vividly to this day when we turned the transmitter on in this spacecraft in orbit around the Earth, and we heard all these really strange sounds.
This particular sound, one of Don Gurnett's favorites, is the sound of the aurora, the Northern Lights. He's also collected the sound of lightning in Earth's upper atmosphere.
Sort of goes like that.
There's one sound in particular from Saturn's aurora. Yep, Saturn has an aurora that is so strange, you can find groups of people online who are convinced it's proof of aliens.
I know, I've heard that. I don't endorse that point of view, but nonetheless, it's pretty bizarre.
SETI director Jill Tarter says aliens would probably not sound like this. Saturn's signal is what's called an astrophysical signal, meaning it occurs naturally in space. SETI looks for a signal that doesn't.
A signal that shows up at only one channel on the radio dial, as opposed to being spread over many channels.
This is an artificial example of what the SETI Institute is listening for. That high-pitched whistle you hear is a signal that occurs on just one frequency. Nature can't produce such a sound.
Nature tends to be broadband. Technology can be broadband, but we can also produce these very narrowband artifacts that are a dead giveaway, that's some engineering there.
And engineering could mean extraterrestrial life. NASA's sharing of the Kepler discovery with SETI represented a change in the way the two agencies have worked in the past. And Jill Tarter says it could mean SETI will work more closely with NASA in the future to determine where habitable planets might be and where to turn their telescopes.
As Carl Sagan said, we are all made out of stardust. You are actually made out of the remnants of that star that blew up billions of years ago. And the connectedness of life to the cosmos and the idea of thinking about maybe life somewhere else, I think has the opportunity to trivialize the differences among humans on this planet that we find so troublesome.
Jill Tarter spoke to our producer, Brent Bachman. You can hear more space sounds on our website, npr.org.
That's all for this week's Science Podcast. You can find all the stories you heard today at npr.org/sciencepodcast. Remember, you can always send an email to sciencepodcast@npr.org to let us know what you'd like to hear. I'm Adam Cole. Have a great week.